You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a look at a court ruling in Texas that could take away the Affordable Care Act requirement to cover some forms of preventive care. Now, some species of bats in Wisconsin are facing extinction because of disease and other environmental factors. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service moved to reclassify the northern long-eared bat as endangered. That goes into effect officially March 31st. The service has also proposed adding the tricolored bat to the endangered species list that could become official later this year. Wisconsin has 8 recorded species of bats. 4 of them are listed as threatened. Each one plays a role in ecosystems around the state. J. Paul White is a mammal ecologist and the bat program lead for natural heritage conservation in the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. I talked to him earlier today. When people think of bats in Wisconsin, probably most of us are most likely to have encountered, I think, the brown bats that are going to live in houses and things like that. The ones we're talking about, though, they're different species. What are the bat species in Wisconsin we're particularly concerned about?
Well, we have 8 different species in the state, and the ones we're worried about are what we consider the cave obligate species or the cave bat species. And these are the bats that are reliant on caves and mines and other suitable hibernation sites to subsist during the winter months. So 6 to 8 months they spend their time underground hibernating. And in particular, they're the ones that are under threat from a disease called white nose syndrome, which has been in Wisconsin since 2014.
Right, we've been tracking this white nose disease, this syndrome, for quite a while. What is the latest on that? Are we seeing it spread, continue to spread?
Certainly continue to see it spread, particularly in the western states. Unfortunately, we have it on both coasts of the United States and certainly up in provinces of Canada as well. So I think at the last count, there were 38 states and 8 Canadian provinces. Unfortunately, we've had it here long enough in Wisconsin to consider it endemic. So pretty much anywhere where you go in Wisconsin, you're going to find it as far as a hibernation site. So all of our bats, to some degree, at least cave bats, have been exposed to this disease for quite a long time and continue to do so.
As I understand it, you've just been down in some caves looking at bats. What kind of things are you looking for and finding?
Yeah, so we're just wrapping up our winter surveillance season where we prioritize sites based on, you know, what we had previously as far as pre-white nose estimates and then species diversity. And unfortunately, we're finding many of the sites that went down to zero kind of early in the disease progression after 2014 when we first found it. We're still finding very few individuals, if not zeros, across the board. And so it's not unheard of to go and visit 3 or 4 sites in any given day and come away with a no bat day. So that's not to say they're all bad news. We have seen some increases in some of our larger sites, which is definitely encouraging. Unfortunately, that's just really the little brown bat is where we're seeing some of those modest increases in stabilization. But in particular, the tricolored bat and the northern long-eared bat are bats that we rarely see anymore and unfortunately are hardest hit by white nose syndrome.
I wanted to ask you about each of those species in turn. First of all, the northern long-eared bat, I understand, being reclassified as endangered. Can you tell us a little bit about the northern long-eared bat, why it's threatened?
Sure. Well, it was originally threatened in 2015, classified as threatened through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And at that point, the disease had been found in much of its range, not over half of it, but it continued to spread throughout its most of its range, and I believe it's found in 37 states and 8 Canadian provinces. So the Fish and Wildlife Service tasked states and other partners to provide more recent information on what they're finding underground, just like we were looking last week. And unfortunately, the news was pretty bad, where we're not really finding northerns on the landscape, not above or below. And so they collected all that information and recently classified it or reclassified it as endangered. And come March 31st, that will go into effect. And with it, a level of protections, federal protections with it.
And then the status of the tricolored bat.
Right. Tricolored bat is a state listed species. And I should say that with the northern long-eared, it's also a Wisconsin state listed species as threatened, and that's currently what the tricolored bat is listed as in the state. We're seeing very similar things here as well. They were never really that abundant in Wisconsin, primarily found in the southwest part of the state in a few places along the Mississippi, but we never really found them to the numbers that we did with, say, little brown bats. And so they are also doing very poorly in much of their range, which is why the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is considering an endangered species status on them as well. But we won't know that until later this year.
And Paul, is there a protection effort that can make a difference for these endangered or threatened bats here in the state?
Well, we continue to work with landowners, both that have roost sites, that have hibernation sites, to ensure that those sites are protected in perpetuity. We know that these are places that bats rely on, as I said, 6 to 8 months spending their life. And so we continue to work with those stakeholders to make sure that those sites are protected, ensuring that only a few individuals would go in a year, perhaps just through white nose research and trying to limit the amount of visitation that they have, and certainly not allowing folks to visit these sites during the winter months when bats are very vulnerable to disturbance.
Paul, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
J. Paul White is a mammal ecologist and the bat program lead for natural heritage conservation in the Wisconsin DNR. He's with us today to look at threats to Wisconsin's bat populations. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a question about education.
Wisconsin is one of 12 states that requires Native American content to be taught in schools. That prompted Maria Novotny to reach out to WPR's Wisconsin Project, asking us how educators are teaching this in the classroom. As WPR's Gabby Vinnick reports, schools are working to integrate indigenous histories, cultures, and tribal sovereignty into the curriculum.
In a Madison West High School classroom, students take their seats in their first period class. This morning, they're talking about news involving the Cherokee Nation and the push to have First Nation representation in Congress. One by one, students like senior Abby O'Callaghan share their questions.
Given the legacy of the federal government and its involvement in the dispossession of Native peoples, how can we move forward at both the local and the state level to kind of make sure that there's a real change in policy?
The class is just one example of how students are connecting the histories of Wisconsin's First Nations to the present day. And it wasn't too long ago that legislation known as Act 31 spurred this education. Since 1991, the law has mandated that public schools and public and private universities teach the histories, cultures, and tribal sovereignty of tribal nations in Wisconsin. It was in response to the violence that erupted in northern Wisconsin in the 1980s. Members of the Ojibwe tribe were spearfishing, and protesters blocked them from exercising a treaty right they reserved. J.P. Leary is of Cherokee descent. He's an associate professor of First Nations Studies at UW-Green Bay. He wrote a book about Act 31.
The real policy problem that Act 31 is addressing is the lack of meaningful opportunities to learn accurate, authentic information about the federally recognized tribes and bands in Wisconsin.
David O'Connor agrees. He's a consultant at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. O'Connor is a member of the Ojibwe tribe and offers educators resources about Wisconsin's First Nations on topics like treaty rights, indigenous languages, and festivities. He encourages educators to weave those lessons into subjects beyond social studies.
If you teach it from a tribal sovereignty lens first, you could teach Native histories and cultures 10 times easier.
Wisconsin is home to 11 federally recognized tribal nations. Teachers like Jeff Ryan of Prescott High School have been working to integrate Native histories more deeply into their lessons. Since 2000, the social studies teacher has taken hundreds of students on a four-day trip to the Lac du Flambeau Reservation in northern Wisconsin. They talk with tribal elders, do craft work, and tour cultural sites.
To gain a full understanding of the experience, whether it be the history or the contemporary issues connected to Native people, you have to access and talk with Native people.
There are more than 500 tribal nations in the U.S. Ryan and his students discuss what that means.
500 ways of thinking, 500 ways of talking, 500 ways of living, 500 ways of being.
Some critics say Act 31 has no teeth. The law requires the subject matter to be taught at least 3 times in grades K through 12. But since Wisconsin is a local control state, it's up to school boards and administrators to implement curriculum. Since its passage, more resources have become available for teachers to use. Even so, O'Connor says that for some educators, it's their first time learning the content. Sometimes it contradicts what they were taught.
For far too long, I always think that First Nations peoples and communities have been seen in curriculum as always long ago and far away, rather than being contemporary.
O'Connor says he hopes more schools make teaching Native histories a priority, because, as he says, failing to do so is a lost opportunity for all.
WPR's Gabby Vinnick brought us that story on First Nations education in Wisconsin's classrooms. And the story idea came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a court ruling in Texas last year has thrown part of the Affordable Care Act into a legal gray area again. This time it's about the requirement to cover preventive care. A Wisconsin expert on health care tells us what's at stake. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Now, the Affordable Care Act requires most insurers to cover certain kinds of preventive care at no cost to patients. But in September of last year, Judge Reed O'Connor of Texas ruled that some measures of the Affordable Care Act, requiring insurers to cover preventive care with no patient cost sharing, are unconstitutional. The judge didn't provide guidelines for putting that part of his ruling into practice, so the future of preventive care coverage is in a bit of a gray area now. A poll from Morning Consult found that about 40% of adults said they would skip preventive care if they lost ACA coverage. That includes things like cardiovascular disease prevention, STI screenings, and diabetes screenings. Rebecca Meyerson is an assistant professor of population health sciences at UW-Madison. She's an expert on the Affordable Care Act. Rebecca, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
All right. Now, this court ruling is pretty complicated. I think even by court ruling standards, we need a couple few lawyers to untangle it. I want to start at the end in some ways. What are your concerns if this means that some forms of preventive care would no longer be covered under the Affordable Care Act?
So this ruling relates to the USPSTF A and B level screening preventive services. And that, as you mentioned, that includes a variety of services that experts have agreed have moderate to high certainty that the net benefits are moderate or substantial. So the evidence suggests these things can really improve health. And so that can include things like cancer screening, depression risk screening for adolescents, screening for HIV for high risk individuals, and even pre-exposure prophylaxis, as well as screening for diabetes and pre-diabetes. So as you mentioned, a number of people may not pay for those if they're required to do so out of pocket. And there is a concern that indeed, if this wasn't required under the ACA, that many private health insurance plans would no longer provide that first dollar coverage, allowing people to access this type of care without without paying for it themselves.
Now, one of the goals of the Affordable Care Act was to boost access to preventive care, to get more people doing it. The idea being, I think that, among other things, it's going to make people healthier and hopefully reduce healthcare costs down the road if we catch things early. As you look back over the years since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, have we seen benefits from this part of it?
So we have. There are various types of evidence related to that. So there was a recent report from the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation that suggested that more than 150 million people with private insurance, another 20 million with Medicaid, 61 million with Medicare, now can have the access to that preventive care without cost sharing because of this provision. Including some who may have had it in the past, but about an increase in about 50 million. So quite a large number of people now have this access. And there have been a number of research studies that look at different types of care and have seen an uptick, increases in preventive screenings, HIV testing, increase in total number of preventive screenings received, About half of people with undiagnosed diabetes were estimated to gain access to screening, resulting in perhaps an earlier diagnosis for diabetes. And then in terms of health outcomes, there has also been evidence that having access to coverage that provides screenings free of charge results in an increase in early stage cancer diagnosis. So it's not necessarily just the case that the additional people getting screened are those who don't have the condition. There are quite a number of people who are screened and do in fact have early stage cancer detected, which in many cases the screening is recommended because early stage disease is more treatable with better outcomes.
Dr. Rebecca Meyerson, Assistant Professor of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison, talking about preventive care requirements under the Affordable Care Act. A judge in Texas calling at least some of that into question in a ruling. Not clear exactly what the impact of that is going to be. Rebecca, I want to look at some of these specific examples. And you mentioned diabetes. Can you talk about how diabetes screening has changed under the Affordable Care Act and a little more on the impact that might have had?
Yes. So in my own research, we estimated that about half of the people aged 18 to 64 with undiagnosed diabetes prior to the passage of the Affordable Care Act gained access to zero cost preventive care due to that section 2713, the section that's been challenged by this lawsuit. In a related study in Oregon some years before, there was a randomized trial that showed that access to coverage that provides free preventive screenings, among other services, significantly does increase the probability of a diabetes diagnosis, as well as the use of diabetes medication. So we can kind of see that different parts of the continuum of diabetes care and are being impacted. People are getting screened, getting diagnosed earlier, and getting treated earlier as well.
I understand another condition you've been following is colorectal cancer and screenings for it. What have we learned there?
Yes. So there are ACA provisions that have reduced cost sharing for cancer screening specifically in the Medicare population. And this happened a little bit earlier, so that was easier to study. So previously, traditional Medicare paid all but $275 for colonoscopy and all but $9 for a mammogram. So reducing those to zero, one might think, could increase take up of those services. And in fact, research has shown about an 8% increase in the diagnosis of early stage colorectal cancer that was the service that was more costly of the two after the requirement for patients to pay was waived under the Affordable Care Act.
Then there's concerns about, if somebody's considering getting a screening of these sorts and they don't know what their coverage is, they don't know if there are requirements that they have a low or no cost screening. What do we know about the impact that has on people's health care decision making?
That's a really important point, I think, because the survey you mentioned in the morning consult also checked to what extent people have heard of this legal challenge, and having heard of the legal challenge may result in some confusion among patients about whether or not they will have to pay for these preventive services. And there's research suggesting that having a high deductible health care plan can reduce the use of preventive care, even when under the Affordable Care Act, people do have first dollar coverage. They don't have to pay for preventive care. So that suggests that a high potential possibility for confusion about what the cost might be can in and of itself reduce take up of preventive care. So we may already see that happening since this ruling came out in September of last year.
But as I understand it, which is not super well, I'll be upfront with you, the court ruling doesn't really change things for people in most situations, right? The preventive care they had access to a year ago is still true, still there, at least for now. Do I have that about right?
Yes, but there may be some confusion. Some people may not realize that it hasn't changed yet and therefore may change their care-seeking behavior just based on their own understanding.
So what are you watching for when it comes to how this all gets resolved and how it might affect people's ability to seek preventive care?
So I would worry that if at the end of all the string of legal challenges, it does become the case that this provision under the Affordable Care Act is removed, that people do have to pay, that no longer have first dollar coverage for preventive care services, that may change this whole trajectory of early stage diagnosis, treatment, and healthcare outcomes. As various research studies have shown, these screening sensitive conditions do show better outcomes when people have thorough insurance that provides first dollar coverage for screenings.
Do you have thoughts on, in just our last few moments, better ways to communicate people about the current state of access to preventive care coverage, whatever that current state might be?
I would suggest that people talk to their primary care provider in their annual checkup. For people in Medicare, there's a free annual wellness visit where people can make a plan for their preventive screenings for the year, and would encourage people to take advantage of that in order to get the best information from their primary care provider and make a plan that matches their risk factors.
Rebecca, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Rebecca Meyerson, Assistant Professor of Population Health Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She talked to us about a court ruling in Texas that could ultimately strike down part of the ACA's requirement that insurers cover many kinds of preventive care with no or low cost to patients. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a related topic, anybody using Badger Care for health coverage in Wisconsin will need to check out their renewal options for the first time in a few years after some COVID-era regulations have ended. Find out what's changing and how it will affect coverage in the state. And a patient receiving vital plasma donations tracked the supply to a big business and the donors, some of the most vulnerable people in the United States. Find out what she learned in the new book called Blood Money. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, distracted driving is dangerous, we know that, but a report from a watchdog group says it's even worse than the numbers might tell us. Get the details, share your thoughts and experiences. I'm Rob Ferret, this is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we catch up on the several ongoing investigations into former President Donald Trump, including a New York case that could see an indictment decision in the coming days. First, 77% of us admit to using our phones while driving. That's according to a survey from the Travelers Insurance Company last year. The survey goes on. 74% of us use cell phone maps. More than half of us read texts or emails behind the wheel. More than a fourth post or scroll through social media. One in five admit to online shopping while driving. An estimated 46,000 people died on U.S. highways in 2022. It's unclear how many of those were a result of distracted driving. Our next guest calls distracted driving an epidemic. He's calling for changes to the ways we collect safety data and the ways we look out for each other on the road. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you seen a lot of distracted driving on the road? Will you admit to being one of those many people who did things with their phones while driving just for a quick minute? Have you changed your habits? Has this affected your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Bruce Landsberg is the vice chair of the National Transportation Safety Board and is on the steering committee of the National Distracted Driving Coalition. Bruce, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be with you, Rob. This is a critically important subject for all of us.
Now, I think we all know distracted driving is pretty dangerous. What you're making the case for in your organization is that the numbers that we might have out there don't really tell the whole story. Why might we be undercounting the impact of distracted driving?
Well, the main reason is that being on the phone doesn't leave a trail. So when someone is in a crash, if they are impaired or if they've been speeding or something like that, there's a trail, if you will, that shows that this is what's going on. unless the police are able to get a subpoena to look at your phone, or unless the driver says, hey, I was talking or chatting on my phone, we don't have that information, and law enforcement is pretty busy. If it's a fender bender, they don't pay a lot of attention to it because they got other things to do. So we think this is badly undercounted, and right now we're making a best guess estimate that the undercount is probably about three times as bad as we think. So a couple of years ago, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration tallied up over 3,400 fatalities nationwide. We think that it's probably closer to about 10,000 fatalities every year. And if you go beyond just fatalities and we go to life-altering injuries, such as burns, amputations, brain damage, et cetera, you're talking hundreds of thousands of people who have had their lives badly altered as a result of a lifestyle choice.
Big picture, Bruce, as I understand the history of traffic safety in the United States, we spent a lot of years getting safer and safer with better road design, safer cars, things like that. And we're actually starting to turn that around. Is that what you're seeing? And how big a factor in that is distracted driving and bending that curve the opposite of the way we'd want it to go?
Well, in various areas, I mean, we've been working on DUI for decades. And the whole concept of just say no hasn't worked with drugs. It hasn't worked with distracted driving or other sorts of impairment. It hasn't worked for speeding very well. And it most certainly doesn't work with personal electronic devices. The devices are basically designed to be addictive. And so people use them. We understand that. So just hoping that people won't use it, as you've seen from some of the data that you cited at the opening of the interview, is that most people are using their phones. And one thing that happened when I came to the NTSB several years ago, they said, we don't use our phones when we're driving, even if it's something critically important. We'll get a hold of you when you get to wherever it is that you're going. And the national trucking companies, such as UPS and Federal Express, they do want to talk to their drivers, but they have a system worked out where they can let the driver know, hey, we want to talk to you, but don't do it while you're driving. Find a safe place in the next 10 or 15 minutes, pull over, and we'll talk about where you need to go next. So there are ways of managing this, but we have to learn to say no. And as individuals, we don't do that very well.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the technological solutions. Are there things that the people who make our phones and their operating systems can do to make it easier for us to say no, or to not even think about it, to opt out in the first place?
Well, absolutely. First off, we think that the phones ought to be defaulted to not operating for non-driving activities when the cars are in motion. And the phone knows when the car is in motion. So far, the phone manufacturers have chosen not to do that. You have to opt in and go to your settings and do it that way. And likewise, the telecom companies could be doing something to manage this. And some people say, well, I use my navigation function. We're not talking about that. Or I listen to music. We're not talking about that. We're talking about talking on the phone, texting, as you said, online shopping, and people playing video games. We have investigated crashes where people have been playing video games or have just absolutely not been paying attention, with a very bad outcome for all concerned.
How about the cars themselves? The technology board in front of us keeps getting bigger and more complicated. Is that part of the story?
Well, I think it absolutely is. I saw one car advertisement recently that said, you know, we have a 14-inch screen. Well, where do you think people are going to be looking? And one of the things that science has done for us, they've looked at this very carefully. If you take your eyes off the road for more than about 3 seconds, the chances of being in a crash start to go up. And the longer you're off the road, the more that increases exponentially. So The science is clear. If you're not looking at the road, you are setting yourself up for a bad day.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Algoma. John, hi.
Hi. I have an Apple phone, and it has an application in it, in the operating system, actually, that allows me to have the phone automatically turn off when I'm driving the car. And I know you were talking about technological solutions, but it's a social issue. And my question is whether your guest has any sample or model legislation for state legislatures which would allow them to require that operating systems have such an application and that it be automatically turned on when you turn the car on.
Great question, John. What do we see out there, Bruce?
John, that is a fabulously good question, and the answer is yes. And the NTSB has come up with some model legislation that can be used. Obviously, the federal government does not control the state driving laws, and NTSB, we don't make rules whatsoever. We merely make recommendations. But we in the NTSB carry Apple phones as well, and we have to set them to the default, or I should say the non-default position, so that the phone knows when we're in motion and it won't buzz at us when we're doing this. So I think that's a great suggestion. If we could get the public to agree to this and to encourage their legislators to vote for it, because the lives you save will be those of your family and friends.
John, thanks for that call. We're talking to Bruce Landsberg, Vice Chair of the National Transportation Safety Board, part of the National Distracted Driving Coalition, looking at the risks of distracted driving, some possible solutions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found ways to maybe boost your willpower and not be distracted by your phone while driving? What kind of things have you seen on the road yourself? If you are in highway law enforcement in some part of it, do you have a story to share about what you've seen out there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Bruce Landsberg, Vice Chair of the National Transportation Safety Board, also with the National Distracted Driving Coalition, looking at data on distracted driving, why the numbers may be understating the problem. You can join in with your questions for our guest, your own stories or experiences at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Oconomowoc. Tom, hi.
Hi, how are you? I think that with all due respect to your guests, it's much too broad an indictment against, quote, the use of cell phones currently. I have a car that's a special interest vehicle, but nonetheless, although it's 10 years old, it was equipped by its manufacturer with an automatic interface for any cell phone that you just clone to it. So anytime I wish to speak to somebody on my cell phone while driving, and I commute back and forth to Chicago at least twice a month, I don't have to do anything except press the microphone button on my steering wheel, which turns around and does everything that I would like it to do, including navigational guidance, et cetera, et cetera. What difference is there in the distinction your guest makes between A, using hands-free cell phone conversation for whatever purpose it may be? This is not game playing or a big screen that you're interacting with. It's simply totally hands-free microphone conversation. What's the difference between that and speaking to a passenger in your car on a long trip?
Tom, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Bruce, hands-free use of cell phones.
Great question, Tom. Thank you. So the academics in the group have done some study with simulators, and they find that hands-free is in fact better than manipulating the phone, which I'm sure you would agree with. The problem comes in with the fact that you are cognitively distracted. And that sounds, you know, that's a 60-cent word, for you're not devoting 100% of your attention to the driving task. And once again, the statistics seem to show that this is a problem. And one of the challenges we have is the idea that the driving environment is tremendously dynamic. And if you're in a high density traffic environment, it can be a real problem where things will change literally within seconds. And if you happen to be thinking about what you're going to say on the next part of the discussion, you may be putting yourself at a disadvantage. How is it different than talking to a passenger? It's not much different than talking to a passenger, but once again, you have total control over that situation as opposed to saying to somebody else, hey, wait, I've got a deal coming up here. The passenger can see what's going on. I'm pretty sure that, you know, a lot of people are not as responsible as you are in the use of your phone. And once again, we're seeing that. To help put this in context, in the aviation industry, we've been coming under a microscope recently, and we haven't had, there have been two fatalities in the last 10 years in scheduled airline flights. We are killing the equivalent of approximately one airliner every single week on the highways from what we estimate is due to distracted driving. Is that acceptable? It's a rhetorical question. I don't think so.
Thanks a lot for that call, Tom. Bruce, I want to bring us back to our starting point. Are there things we can do to collect data better so we can get a grasp on how big a problem distracted driving is?
Yeah, I think there are. And that would be, again, there are companies called telematics, or that's the general descriptive term, that can track these kinds of things. And there are apps that you can put on your phone. Some insurance companies are encouraging people to do that. And it gets us to a point of, you know, why are people so hooked on this? And why are the phone companies so hooked on it? It all comes down to economics. There's a lot of money to be made when people are online, whether they're driving or otherwise. And so, you know, we look at this and we say, well, I'm not going to have a crash. I've never had a crash. I'm not going to. That's what we refer to as optimism bias. And we're not very good at self-assessing how well we do. And I guess one of the key points, Rob, is every single person that was involved in a distracted driving crash, when they got in their car, was absolutely certain that it wasn't going to happen to them. And it's hard for us to get through that mindset because it's hardwired into every one of us.
Time for one more quick call from Cyril in Madison. Cyril, hi.
Hi, Rob. I just wanted to bring up an issue regarding the engineering and the software that's going into all these modern vehicles now. You have automatic emergency braking, you have blind spot warning, you have lane departure warning, you have lane keeping assistance.
I gotcha, sir. We don't have a lot of time left, but Bruce, are these part of the solution, those things that slow you down when the car in front of you slows down?
Absolutely. We're a big belief in the driver-assisted equipment. We're a long ways yet, though, from the fully automated vehicles that you hear so much about. Until we get to being fully automated, I think we're going to have to be really careful about how we divert our attention from the roads.
Thanks for that call, Cyril. And Bruce, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you. And everybody, please, the call can wait. Get to your destination.
That's Bruce Landsberg, vice chair of the National Transportation Safety Board and part of the National Distracted Driving Coalition. He joined us today with a look at distracted driving and possible solutions. You can keep sharing your thoughts over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Wisconsin voters will choose a new state Supreme Court justice next month, with the ideological lean of the court hanging in the balance. The new court will be asked to weigh in on any number of hot-button issues, including the state's abortion ban. But it could also consider a challenge to the state's political district maps, which have been called among the most gerrymandered in the nation. As Bridget Bowden reports, it has the potential to shape the state's political landscape for years to come.
In statewide elections in Wisconsin, sometimes Republicans win. Sometimes it's Democrats. But when it comes to which party controls the legislature, it's never close. With the help of the redistricting plan they first drew more than a decade ago, Republicans win every time. In 2015, Wisconsin Democrats thought they had the answer to this, a new standard to measure gerrymandering that would give federal courts the ability to decide when maps were too partisan. They took the idea all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. But the day they made their arguments, it was obvious that some of the justices weren't ready to go there.
And it may be simply my educational background, but I can only describe as sociological gobbledygook.
A couple years later, the Supreme Court slammed the door to the idea that partisan gerrymandering could be solved in federal courts. But according to University of Wisconsin-Madison law professor and redistricting expert Rob Yablon, that wasn't the end of the road.
The court in that decision explicitly left the door open for state courts to consider partisan gerrymandering claims under their own state constitutions.
And that's why the maps are a huge issue in this year's race for an open seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, where liberal Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz is facing conservative former Justice Dan Kelly. If Protasiewicz wins, it would flip the ideology of the court for the first time since 2008. And that could be big for Wisconsin's maps, Yablon says, because someone could challenge them in court.
I have little doubt that if the court's composition changes, someone is going to try to pursue that case.
The state's current maps were drawn by Republican legislators in 2021. They were based on maps that Republicans drew 10 years before. In that time, the GOP has held strong control of both houses of the legislature, even in years when Democrats did well in statewide elections. Yablon says different maps might change that.
If the Wisconsin Supreme Court adopted new maps, those maps would by no means guarantee that the Democrats would take control of the legislature, but it would at least raise the possibility that there would be a meaningful fight for legislative control.
That could open the door to any number of policy changes that Democrats haven't been able to pursue in recent history, like expanding Medicaid, legalizing marijuana, and codifying abortion rights. Protasiewicz, the candidate backed by Democrats, says she'd like to take a fresh look at the maps.
So let's be clear here. The maps are rigged, bottom line. Absolutely, positively rigged. They do not reflect the people in this state.
Protasiewicz stops short of saying how she would rule in a redistricting lawsuit, saying she's merely expressing her values. Kelly, the candidate backed by Republicans, takes issue with that.
I think when someone tells you what their values are in answer to a legal question, they're telling you how they're going to decide a case.
He defends the maps and says personal values shouldn't come into play when deciding a legal question. Rick Essenberg is the president of the conservative Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. He says even if a map challenge were to be brought before the state Supreme Court, he doubts a violation of the Wisconsin Constitution could be proven.
The problem is that there really isn't anything in the Wisconsin Constitution other than a requirement that the maps be contiguous and compact. And the thing about the maps in Wisconsin is that they are contiguous and compact.
But Jeff Mandel, board president of the liberal group Law Forward, believes there are provisions in the Wisconsin Constitution that the maps violate. He says there's no hard and fast plan for how to challenge the maps yet.
But there are plenty of conversations going on about what such a lawsuit would look like, who would be included, what claims it would make, and how it would proceed.
If the court flips, he says it's likely a challenge is filed pretty quickly. The new justice will be seated on August 1st. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
On a related note, join us tonight at 7 for a rebroadcast of this week's Wisconsin Supreme Court candidate debate. Former Supreme Court Justice Dan Kelly and Judge Janet Protasiewicz participated in the State Bar of Wisconsin's candidate debate yesterday. You can hear that rebroadcast again. That's tonight at 7 on Wisconsin Public Radio, or stream it at WPR.org. Coming up after the news, a Manhattan grand jury did not meet today regarding their investigation into former President Donald Trump. We'll talk about what we do know about that case and what could happen if the grand jury decides to support an indictment of the former president. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.